I was intrigued one time by someone who said, I've wondered what a talk would be like if it was called Silence, Shame, and Empathy. And so I began studying on it a little bit, and we have something that we can offer you based on an experience that we had with a client. And I just give it to you in that way. There's some instruction and some information for and encouragement for clients who have been through some of these things, and there's also instruction for the empathic people that we have in the office or the room. And I really, really appreciate all of you support parents who have come to help and to come alongside the hurting. How does silence, shame, and empathy happen? I saw a client for a while whom I will call Jessica. She grew up as a sensitive, firstborn child with well-meaning parents. However, her dad tended to be passive and disengaged, while her mom tended to be rule-oriented and legalistic. Jessica came for therapy in her late 20s, feeling hopeless and depressed, to the point that it affected her ability to function as a wife and mother. I had sensed she felt very down, and she would mention many times how she felt an overwhelming amount of shame. I would at times say, "Do you know God made you special?" One day, when I asked her that question again, she sort of lashed out. "Don't keep asking me that question. I'm not special." I asked her, "Why do you think that you're not special? What happened that taught you you're not special?" She told me of a story she had completely forgotten until that moment. She remembered a five-year-old Jessica overhearing her parents talking to her grandma about a gift that Jessica from grandma. Jessica couldn't understand everything, but she didn't understand enough to know that her grandma had a gift for her. But mom and dad were telling grandma that Jessica couldn't have it. Jessica didn't know why her parents didn't want her to have the gift, but she did know that grandma was good at making her feel special, when her parents did not so much. Jessica's little mind decided that it must be bad for her to feel special, and bad to even want to feel special. She could not stop her desire to feel special, though, so she just began to associate shame with any desire to feel special. And she tried to hide that desire through silence. With that example of how shame started, let's look at an overview of this topic. Silence, shame, and empathy work like this. Shame comes in many forms, but it cannot stand to be known. It can hide a long time if it needs to. This leads to silence, where shame grows to take on more and more of the person's persona. This trap can be broken when a person is willing to safely expose their shameful places. This can happen with someone who can empathize and model better understandings through healthy mentoring. Just as a gentle note here, sometimes a talk can hit you very hard, and it's not the intention of the speaker. But it can bring a realization to you that you had not known or understood. If that is your experience today, please take care of yourself. You may want to get up and take some time for yourself, or write down a clarifying question that we could talk about later. I'm really okay with that. So let's delve into silence a little bit. The following passage is defining the human mental and emotional response to abuse in Psalms. They also that seek after my life lay snares for me. This is Psalm 38, 12 to 14. And they speak to my hurt, speak mischievous things, and imagine deceits all the day long. But I, as a deaf man, hear not. And I was as a dumb man that opened not his mouth. Thus I was as a man that heareth not, and in whose mouth is no reproofs. These verses poetically describe the human mental and emotional response to abuse. I hear not. I have no category for what is happening. It can't be what it seems like. I'm in some kind of shock or denial, which prevents me from moving to seek protection. I open not my mouth. I have no words, only shame. There is no help. I feel powerless. I am not heard. Many words swirl around me, but none are mine. Their ideas and interpretations dominate, while mine are overpowered. This is what it feels like to many who experience abuse. This is how silence works. The problem with silence, why the perpetrator likes silence. When a child begins to believe that they are shameful, they become much more vulnerable to abuse. Silence allows abuse to continue. Abuse, for this talk, will refer to sexual abuse, physical abuse, manipulation by those in power, any kind of intimidation or other misuse of power. Silence empowers the offender. His need for power cannot be satisfied, but must continue to feed on its prey. Silence breeds and sustains shame. Silence allows shame to fully take hold of the child as the child matures. Silence allows shame to remain unchallenged. The perpetrator will reinforce it at will to keep the child in place and quiet. Family secrets keeps the victim powerless when the victim feels helpless, hopeless, and alone. They no longer think so much about their future, but about what is happening to them that day. In the dark silence, shame eats up all a person's resources and stymies natural growth like a parasite. Why the victim stays silent? Silence gives the victim a sense of power, false power. If I just don't say anything or even think about it, it will go away. And I wonder how many here have thought those thoughts and it didn't work. So many have experienced molest and abuse think this, and it lets them feel in control of something. Like with an abusive spouse, after an incident is over, it somehow feels easy to believe the abuser is different because he's nice between episodes. It forces the silent one to change friends. The victim must not let anyone know too much. Thus, the group of friends continues to get smaller. Anything that gets too close to the trauma she is experiencing may trigger a victim again. These choices are the victim's type of power. They must avoid certain books, educational material, videos, and such like. Their sense of power comes from knowing they can be silent rather than enjoy things most enjoy. Let's go back to shame a little bit, spend some time there. Back to Jessica. It took Jessica a long time to openly cooperate with my questions because she was so afraid I was trying to get her to set her up and shame her for her answers. One day she told me about a test question from high school. It asked the students for an opinion of the material. The teacher gave low scores if he thought they were dishonest, and he gave low scores if he thought their opinion displayed a bad attitude. But by expressing anything negative, it felt demoralizing, like a no-win situation. So Jessica wrote a long, extra long, rambling answer that ultimately gave no opinion. When he read it, the teacher was confused, but he passed her because he interpreted the wordiness as effort. Jessica felt hidden and powerful. She had escaped his shaming guilt trip. What is shame? Shame is a normal, God-given emotion, alerting us to something that might lead to rejection from God or others. With healthy shame's motivation, we take steps to repair any damage through good communication and prayer. Healthy shame puts responsibility for actions on the one performing those actions. Against thee and thee only have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest and be clear when thou judgest. Psalms 451:4. Let's look at some biblical understanding of where shame was born. In the garden before the fall, there was no shame. Genesis 2 says that they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Then sin came to mankind. This brought shame-based behavior. The eyes of them both were opened, and they knew they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons. It also brought shame-based thinking. And he said, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. Just a disclaimer. Some shame came as a result of sin. However, as a survivor of abuse from someone else's sin, I am not saying that all feelings of shame are a result of our own sin. And I hope you get that part. Teaching healthy shame with boundaries. Healthy boundaries are taught in the home by example first. So is shame. Role modeling this is vital in the home. We need to teach our children about good touch and bad touch, how to say no, about proper care of our bodies, and about God's design for our bodies and our new life. A little story about healthy boundaries. Every day is a new day. I had a foster mom, and I'd love to run her through the copier, and I have about 500 more like her, who kept 6 adolescent children, girls. One of my clients lived there, and she was no easy person. Angry, aggressive, had her mind made up that she knew how to beat the system. The house was quiet and orderly. I commented to the foster mom about this, and she said, yes, every day is a new day. They start out new every morning, forgiven, happy, carefree, no baggage left from the day before. The girls like this, and I have very little trouble. The girls help each other to stay free of consequences. As I have observed this consistent method of discipline, I have become increasingly encouraged by its production, that it produces good fruit. It certainly produces healthy boundaries and a minimum of shame. One story from a mom of a 7-year-old who practiced this after experiencing this method for a while. The child said, Mommy, when I want to do something I should not, I think of the consequence, and then I just don't do it because I don't like the consequence. That's from a 7-year-old. Toxic shame goes a step farther than healthy shame, promising that if I am truly known, I will be rejected instead of loved, because at my core, I am deeply broken and worthless. With toxic shame, we hide any perceived damage to the relationship, like Adam and Eve hiding in the garden. In a situation where an offender harms an innocent person, toxic shame puts the disgrace of sin on the victim instead of the offender, like Tamar and Ammon. So toxic shame avoids healthy placement of responsibility and attacks the other person's sin or perceived wrong instead. Second Corinthians says, for godly grief produces a repentance that leads to salvation without regret, but worldly grief produces death. With Jessica, I think shame may have even started before she was 5. Still at this age is when she began to feel not special, which is a synonym of shame as I see it. Once shame grabbed hold, it did not require much to incubate further. Other thoughts and experiences continued to confirm the shame, especially as the shame glasses for interpreting the world grew stronger. She developed a deeper belief that God did not make her special. In fact, He made me not special. Jessica told me with a deep sense of shame, love itself triggered more shame because I felt unworthy to receive love. It even felt morally wrong for me to receive love or good things. Jessica's parents just thought she was sensitive and shy and well-behaved. They did not know how much shame she was already living under. How might our familial environment bring shame or blame or breed shame? And here's just a small list. Constant criticism, negative thinking, poor boundaries, easy or inattentive parents, busy or inattentive parents, poor training, lack of consistent discipline, threatening to tell or do something to the family if you don't obey, comparing you to your siblings or cousins, threatening God's wrath for small misdemeanors, manipulative behavior to force obedience brings shame and anger. Might it be better to highlight choice and how it may have consequences rather than forced obedience? I'd love to spend time on that one. If we were raised under a shame-based social or church structure, we are likely to continue to feel shame as we grow up. As we hide our shame, might we be likely to hide our ongoing wrongdoing behavior? That's a yes, by the way. Often we need increased amounts of isolation to feel comfortable, especially if we live in a culture of shame and fear. Jessica married a tall, dark, and handsome boy from a nice Anabaptist family. He seemed like her ticket to a better life, even though she still carried the shame and did not feel special. She was going to make this work. What happened then really solidified her feelings of not being special. Her husband of 2 months began speaking roughly and condescendingly to her. He degraded her with angry accusations and bad language. He began to limit who her friends were and to control what she did. Their intimacy was largely about him and his pleasure. She relied on fantasy thinking as an escape. She felt guilty because she knew it was wrong, but she couldn't seem to stop. It's impossible to enjoy intimacy the way God intended with an unsafe spouse. And she stayed silent. For one thing, he wasn't mean all the time. She just knew when he would, never knew when he would flip on her. She told herself it wasn't that bad, that everyone has struggles. Later, when she became pregnant with their second son, and even after he was born, husband did not like or want him. Then suddenly, the son died at 2 years old. She silently grieved because she loved him so dearly. But she was relieved. Her son didn't have to live anymore with a father who didn't like him. She felt confused, guilty, and ashamed about her feelings of relief. Toxic shame is undeserved shame, like carrying guilt for someone else's sin. When a child is blamed for a sin of an adult, they may begin to have shame that is too heavy to bear. Silence to keep the shame from others and bringing much confusion and despair into the life of an innocent child. Psalms 35, let not them that are mine enemies wrongfully rejoice over me, neither let them wink with the eye that hate me without a cause. For they speak not peace, but they devise evil, deceitful matters against them that are quiet in the land. And I just want to put in there, the quiet in the land would be our children, wouldn't they? Who cannot speak. Toxic shame can bring frustration and anger, which leads to rebellion, moving to new churches, or worse. Some shame may label a person for life. Things we can say that bring labeling shame. What's wrong with you? You never do that right. What are you thinking? You will never be good enough. And more and more. Toxic shame is intended for denying the real shame of another. Like in the case of the victim and perpetrator, where the perpetrator puts blame and shame on the victim. Victims hang onto undeserved shame because it protects these memories. Many who carry significant shame orient their life around keeping others from knowing that they are what they are protecting. When I encouraged Jessica to broaden her friend base, she always gave reasons why that person would not be a good fit. Most times, her reluctance revolved around the possibility of finding her shame exposed. Little did I know at that time, she was also protecting herself from her husband, who did not want her to have very close friends. Toxic shame is due to wrong thinking around actual sin. Another type of toxic shame is when we have sinned and asked forgiveness, but then we hang on to the shame after forgiveness, as if God hasn't forgiven. This keeps us stuck and unproductive in the kingdom work of God that God has for us. It feels deserved and right, but it serves no positive or godly purpose. This can be very harmful to our ability to ask God to let God heal and will keep us from His harmony and peace. Both Peter and James had shame, didn't they? I'm sorry, both Peter and Judas had shame. And each took a different route and came to a different end. Toxic shame may also be a conduit of pride, where we ought to humbly accept by faith God's teachings on repentance and forgiveness. Are we following? Shame culture and pastoral care. This could get a bit sensitive. I'm not meaning for it to do, but I think it needs to be said. Cultural shaming. This can be familial, congregational, community, or national pronouncement of shame, hoping to keep a behavior in control or to deny a real one. If we blame the victim, we spare the perpetrator. How about the boys in Haiti who had been violated and then labeled as homosexual by the community and friends? The children who had been violated and told they needed to apologize to the perpetrator by the family or church and shunned by the church because of they had sinned. The cultural part of Jessica's story. Jessica had parents most would respect. They were good members of their church. It looked like they were doing a good job as a conservative Anabaptist family. Jessica went to a church school. She learned certain things well, like fitting in to avoid shaming from her peers. She learned to do a good job at school, academically, to avoid guilt trips from the teacher about God's displeasure and wrath. She learned how to look like she was behaving well even when she wasn't. She carefully crafted a good girl persona that was partly authentic and partly put on, that kept her from a lot of trouble. Another example of cultural shaming is culturally, Assyrians, and we have a large group of them in our area, do not like to be thought of as crazy, because that label can stay with them for a lifetime. They will come to therapy if I don't see any other Assyrian people. That's been asked me more than once, especially the older population. This shame of maybe being seen as having a mental illness is very high in that culture. After they are there a little, they can begin to not care so much about the stigma because they find it helpful, and they may learn a little more about the culture and how the culture can actually stop a person's growth at times. As I begin this next section, I want you to know I am not pointing out any certain congregation or denomination, and I am not. I want for us each one to examine ourselves, because I have witnessed this to some degree in many denominations. Is shaming needed for compliance with God's teaching? Certain cultural dynamics can make it very difficult for an individual to come out of shame. Sometimes a culture might pair shame with strong teaching on submission to get compliance, without enough teaching on loving, safe leadership. Shame cultures can tend to teach what to think, like lists of rules, in place of how to think, or how to understand and think scriptural principles through to a practical application. Shame cultures discourage the healthy expression and struggle of the individual. This all replaces love as the motivator of joyful cooperation and healthy development together. The imbalance might come with good intention, like a desire to keep someone or everyone safe and holy and unified. As a child matures into adulthood, they begin to need more than yes, no type guidance. However, in a church culture where anything other than yes, no thinking threatens the structure of government, shame, spiritual intimidation, and other tactics become unintentionally or intentionally tools. When people feel threatened by intimidation or shame, they often quiet down about their questions, concerns, and even their hurts. People who grow up in this environment often have trouble differentiating between actual sin from simple preferences of the group. Even if a person can say which is sin versus which is preference, the preference issue may feel more significant than the sin issue, depending on how, on which is more targeted with shame-based teaching. God created us with desires. Desires tend to be a problem area for many who live under shame. God created us with desires. He called us what? He called us good. After sin entered, perversions of God-given desires proliferated. As Christians, we do well to war against perverted desires. However, we do not do well to war against perverted desires by warring against all desires. When we fight sin by placing shame on all desires, that doesn't give us extra protection. It creates more perverted desires. Healthy desires, repressed, tend to go underground and reemerge in twisted forms. Preventing distorted desires helps by embracing pure, healthy desires, not by fearing or shaming them. I want to talk now just a little bit about empathy. What is empathy? Toxic shame isolates and silence hides. How much more time do I have? Oh, good. Thank you. I can slow down. Kick it into neutral. The healthy power of empathy. What is empathy? Toxic shame isolates and silence hides. The antidote then is empathy. It's the ability to understand another person's thoughts and feelings in a situation from their point of view rather than your own. Empathy gives the victim a safe place to expose their shame where they will be believed. When a person exposes their shame and meets validation from someone who models love and care, the victim can be rescued and restored from shame, and this breaks the power of silence. How to empathize, and we could spend a whole session on this. It is very easy for a survivor to feel great hesitancy in wanting to give up any of their shame. And the silence that surrounds it because they see it as their only successful way to successfully navigate life. Develop a relationship. Have I said develop a relationship yet? This includes a lot of trust between you and the survivor. And this may be tested many times as you start to get close to working on the actual shame. The process will feel very threatening to the survivor, especially at the beginning, and they may direct all their self-protection reactions at you. They also will let you in a little bit at a time. It can seem like a long time to you before any progress is made. And this is so true. Stay with them, even when it doesn't seem like anything is happening. We'll get into Jessica's response to this. Listen carefully. Believe them. Acknowledge and validate the feelings of their experience. If you know what started the shame, validate how hard the experience must be. Model appropriate emotions. Tenderness and grief toward the victim. Righteous anger toward the perpetrator. Recognize the truth regarding the perpetrator and the victim. Speak freely in a truthful way regarding both. The perpetrator did a sinful thing to this child. assign healthy biblical shame to the perpetrator. The victim survivor is the innocent party and should be recognized as such. Refuse to shame the child. No labeling. Dissolve any misconceptions in the survivor's mind regarding who they are and are not. This is important due to how the abuse and shame can change how they think about themselves. Affirm biblical truth regarding what was done to them. Help the victim survivor hold their head up in their family, church, and community. As much as you can, speak openly to their families, providing education to address any toxic thinking while protecting the survivor's confidence. That usually means that before you talk to the parents, you have a conversation with the client and get an okay from them as to what you're going to say. Recognize an adolescent victim who you might think ought to know better as not the perpetrator. A child that needs better parental training and supervision, maybe. And the adult is the perpetrator. The survivor must know you will not leave the person, but you are there for the completion. I'm not sure how many times or how often Jessica said to me, "Will you leave me?" Or, "Please don't leave me." Or, "I'm not sure if you will leave me." That you will hold their confidence is so important. If they begin to let you in, you cannot break that silence outside the relationship you have with them. Everything I share about Jessica is with her permission. As time passes, trust is built, and they discuss it more to you, more so you become a real safety net for them to come to. How does empathy help overcome shame? Empathy breaks the silence of shame, and shame cannot survive this. It is not easy work and can be very slow to be the empath for a person with deep shame, but the rewards are great. Like a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him, for he knoweth our frame. He remembereth that we are dust, and we must be the same way to them. Feeling and understanding another's feelings, emotions is a powerful experience. It needs to be done in a way that brings faith, trust into the picture for the other. The need for empathy is not feeling sorry for the victim, but showing the truth to the victim in a loving, caring way. Empathy connects on an emotional level, where education and other attempts cannot. This is why Christian counseling is so much better many times. Empathy helps bridge the gap that is created in trauma and other abuses, including parental violence and aggressive behavior. Empathy reduces tension in the self and allows room to see things differently. Opening up to a person can also begin with journaling your own story by yourself or at the counsel of another, so you can get it out of your head and be able to share it with another, with your own eyes and another person. This can be very cathartic and help us reduce shame. A couple things that empathy is not. Empathy is not a quick fix many times. Empathy is not putting on love like a Band-Aid. I love this person, so she ought to hear me and just do it. I have spoken in love to so what's the problem? Empathy is not getting frustrated when you feel like the person isn't responding. I spent a lot of time feeling sorry for her. She doesn't think I understand. Empathy is not chatting with others about what you have been told. Seriously, if you cannot be confidential, do not do this work. You will hurt the survivor more than help. If you feel you need help, ask permission of the victim before going to someone. This builds trust. Empathy brings victory. Process of feeling special. Jessica's ending story of empathy, victory, feeling special, and the process of that change. I'll finish up Jessica's story by sharing some questions I ask her. What were the things that helped you? She answered, when you ask why I didn't feel special, or when it was I hadn't thought of that stuff for a super long time, and I didn't know it impacted me. But when you ask in that moment, that came up for me. It was so weird. And then letting you walk me through a different understanding of what was going on there, and being able to start believing when you said good things about me. Next question, what began the process of this change, and how long did it take you to really believe in the saying that you're special? She says, the way you treated me, I couldn't believe how much you seemed to care. I don't remember the length of time. Trust started building way earlier than the event for me to be able to open up to you about it. After we talked about the event with my grandparents' gifts that my parents didn't want me to have, I could begin to see what was going on, and the not special feeling started to lose its power. It is still easy for me to revert to not feeling special if I'm stressed and not paying attention, but I'm getting a lot better at catching it when I do. I can choose to move into truth. Having the choice is what's new, and now it's a matter of consistently choosing to believe the truth where before I couldn't get there emotionally. Another question, was there anything that really helped you solidify it in your mind? She says, your consistency of interest and care, even when I knew I was frustrating. I mean, I didn't try to be frustrating, but I was so messed up, I couldn't do what needed to happen sometimes. I was super afraid of displeasing you. So if I felt like I could do the things you were asking better, I definitely would have. I was really afraid you'd decide I was wasting your time, and then you'd leave me, and I'd be on my own again. One time, she says, we listened to that father's love letter thing, and that was a powerful moment for me because I felt safety and care in your presence because of the relationship we had developed that I wasn't used to associating with God. This is harder to talk about than I expected. I worked with Jessica on other issues also, but providing empathy toward her shame was the first step that allowed her to move on to the other issues. I've given you a story of something that fell into the category of silence, shame, and empathy. But I've had other stories of grief that wasn't so easily taken care of. In conclusion, I just want to say it is vital that we speak and listen with grace. Being invited into a person's space to hear their stories is an honor and a privilege not to be taken lightly. Romans 12 says, let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. And if we've got question time, I guess we could take some. But I just would like to say that I hope that this builds for each one of us toward our end goal of a life of love.